Prefigurative historical events. Yeah, I got the words right this week. And that is what we continue to look at as we go through the life of the Hebrews as they leave Egypt and begin this, what people call wandering in the wilderness. And I don't think it's wandering when you have a cloud of a pillar of fire, a cloud that is guiding you from place to place. That doesn't sound like it's being, people are wandering. They're being directed. And they're being directed for their own good. And that is where we're going to start with this word, Beshilach, which is translated after he had let go. After Pharaoh had let the people go, Elohim did not guide them to the highway that goes through the land of the Philistines. Get back to that in just a few moments. This is one of those areas in which the English language really lets us down as far as the meaning of something. And it's something that I think we can, if we grasp this one concept, is going to help us all the way through this Torah portion and through our own wondering or being guided on our journey toward the kingdom. So the word Beshilach is a bait, a sheen, a lamed, and a hay. Let's just briefly look at the pictograms here. Of course, the bait is a house. Excuse me. The sheen is the letter of El Shaddai. It is known as his fingerprint. The lamed is the letter of the king or the shepherd's staff. And the hay is his breath, his authority. So within this word and the concept of them being brought forth out of Egypt, what do we see? We see that it's all about them being restored to his house, that his fingerprint is on everything, that he is guiding them with his staff to the house of the king, and he is doing so through his breath and his authority. All right, so that kind of sets us up a little bit different, I think, to go through this. What does it mean to us? It means that in everything that we are going through today, and, you know, news media, all these different things, our own very, the very essence of our life, everything is being orchestrated by the Almighty. And the number one thing I think we should be doing today is learning how to see his presence in everything that is around us. There is nothing. As you read through the Psalms, you read through the prophets, you read through even the Gospels, or from cover to cover on this, what do we see? That he is in the midst of us. And he is directing our lives. And I'm going to give you a tip at the end regarding what we should be doing on that. But he leads them not through the shorter route, but through a longer route that is going to take them around the area of the Philistines so they will not see war. Now, we go to verse, 18? And it says, the people of Israel went up from the land of Egypt. David Stern translates it fully armed. We could translate this as in battle array. They looked like a great army. You know, we get this idea, I guess, because of the movies of, you know, a bunch of ragtag slaves coming out of Egypt and their wagons and the wheels are falling off. No, they're not the ones with the wheels falling off. That's later on. But they came out of there in a looking like a battalion of soldiers is what the wording here is. But they only looked the part on the outside. They were not ready for war on the inside. And we will see toward the end of this, at the end of this Torah portion, that they will have their first battle, their first conflict. But at this point in time, there's some things that need to go on. Understanding that the Father knows us better than we know ourselves is a key of life. And he will direct us not in the direction and path that we believe that, you know, we're ready for this. I'm ready to see this out. And then, you know, he knows that if he allowed that, that we would be destroyed along the way. So he leads us in the direction, even though in our minds it may have been, as it was for the Hebrews, it's a longer, might have been a little bit more difficult. But in the end, he took them and he will take us on the road that is the best for us. And to show that he is leading them along the way, in verse 21, he gives them this this cloud, and they are to follow the cloud. That is their really the only thing that they've got to do along the way. They don't have to come up with maps. Nobody's got to invent a GPS. They don't have to, you know, learn astronomy and navigation in the wilderness and all those things. No, all they have to do is follow this cloud. Wow, seems too simple, doesn't it? And that's probably why a lot of people have a difficult time. Because today, again, prefigurative historical events, we need to learn how to follow the pillar of fire and the pillar of cloud. Now, I know that in their day, that was a physical pillar of fire, a physical pillar of cloud. But how do we do this? It's called his shalom, his peace. We just went through a time as in our family that Kathy is, as I'm recording, she's preparing to go and spend some time with her brother and sister-in-law. And it's been they both have some very bad health issues right now. And so she's going to go and spend some time. Well, this has been on again, off again, on again, off again. And in the end, her statement to those that to the siblings of her sister and brother-in-law is this: I'm just following what I have peace about. That a week ago, when she was supposed to leave, she didn't have peace about it, but now she does. And so, in the midst of it, how do we walk? How should we be walking through our lives? Learn to follow the peace that passes all understanding. This does not mean that it will be that the direction we go will be without conflict, will be without trials, will be without struggles. But the shalom, and this is where the difference in the word in English peace and the word shalom in Hebrew, which is more of an inward thing. The word peace, we consider it, you know, that two countries are at peace instead of war, but yet both countries are struggling and trying to figure out how to get into the next war and to win. The word shalom is something that's inward. It's something that only the Father can give you and no man can take away. It does not matter what the situations are around us. When we are walking in his shalom, then the outward circumstances of life, though they may affect us in various ways, they are in the end fairly meaningless. Because we understand the words of Shaul, what can man do to me? We understand the words of the psalmist David, when he spoke about that, you know, the enemies are raging around me. And I'm not quoting specific psalms here, specific psalms. But if you go through and you read his words, there was all kinds of turmoil around him. But in the end, he knew the Father was directing him, was fighting for him, and would see him through no matter what the outcome looked like. Moving on, we see that Egypt, now, I mean, Egypt's behind them. Okay, you know, Pharaoh's gone. We're done with that. The plagues are behind us. And here we are running out here into the wilderness. And there's that pillar of cloud. And there's that pillar of fire. Doesn't that look cool? And we have no worries here regarding Egypt. It's all done and behind us. Wrong. All of a sudden, they figure out, no, Pharaoh has, his heart has been hardened a little bit further than it even was in the first place, and he is starting to breathe down their necks. Now, in the mind probably of them, in our mind, it's like, okay, wait a minute, we left them behind. What's the problem here? Couldn't they just kind of go back to their own life, rebuild Egypt? No, there has to be something. There is another aspect of this that has to be taken care of. I'll get to that in just a moment. But what happens is in chapter 14, starting in verse 10, Israel cried out to Adonai, to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh. Now remember, in chapter 2, they were crying, but it was just kind of misdirected cries. Here, they've learned who to cry to. They haven't learned the right way to cry, though. You know, if you've been around children, babies, you know, a child can cry out just in anger, just because it's something that they think that their little lungs need to do, or they can cry out in such a way that it brings forth the nourishment that they need in their own lives. So it's not that they're crying out in a positive manner of Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, Hashem, God, you have just taken us through all of this. We remember the mighty works that you did over what is believed to be the last year in Egypt. And here we are. There must be a purpose for this. There must be a purpose for Pharaoh and his armies coming after us, and we're crying out to you for deliverance. No, that's not the kind of crying they're doing. We see what it is in the next, as we continue reading, because what they were crying out to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, they now spoke to Moshe. And it says, was it because there weren't enough graves in Egypt that you brought us out to die in the wilderness? Why have you done this to us, bringing us out of Egypt? Didn't we tell you in Egypt to let us alone? We'll just go on being slaves for the Egyptians. It will be better for us to be the Egyptians' slaves than to die in the desert. Really? Do you not remember the beatings? Do you not remember what slavery is about? No, the short memory here of what Egypt really was. This is something. Let me go to a place that's this is one of those areas I probably should leave alone, but I'm not going to because I normally don't. The religious system that many of us came out of. Yes, there were some good things. There were some good times. There was some garlic and leeks and onions and fish and some blessings that were a part of that system. But it also came through some pain. The pain of a people placing their burdens upon you, the man-made doctrines and teachings that did not bring life. I'm going to kind of cut that one short and let you, you know, you can deal with that one however you want to in the end. But make sure that the memories that you have of the place that he brought you out of are accurate memories. That you're not just glossing over some in order to focus on those that you are longing for. In the process, Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh is more committed to the people than they are to him. This is, again, another one of those great statements of looking at this as the events that happened then are going to happen again, and maybe even are happening right before our eyes today. An understanding of this, that he, thank him, he is more committed to us than we can ever be unto him. Now, that's not a negative thing, okay? You and I may be walking in such a way that is wholehearted toward him. I got that. I know people today that are walking wholeheartedly. I mean, I look at their lives and it's like, that is amazing that they've been able to find that place of walking toward him. But no matter the close to perfected, wholehearted walk that you have, understand that it is nowhere close to the commitment that he has to us. Now, the cloud moves, and kind of a funny thing happens in that as the cloud moves, the cloud, which I believe is a picture, a prophetic picture of Messiah, who is leading them, is now their protector. The cloud comes around behind them and is a barrier now between the Egyptians and the Hebrews. We see the angels. This is that crazy picture. I see the angels having fun with some lug wrenches and the like, and, you know, removing the lug nuts off the wheels or however they were held on. But literally, the wheels on their chariots start to fall apart. And then we see the essence of the reason for this scenario that's come about. That, remember back, that the Hebrews had literally sold themselves into the slavery of the Pharaoh. So, as long as the Pharaoh is still alive, they are still slaves to him. The reason for the Pharaoh's hardness of heart and then going into the wilderness after them and the parting of the Red Sea, then the sea comes back together, killing all of them. And I remember seeing the first time the movie The Prince Out of Egypt, Prince of Egypt? Yeah, I think it is the cartoon. And you know, it's got Pharaoh there, the stepbrother of Moshe or whatever, and he's like, you know, Moses from the rock over there. No, that's not the way it was, because the Pharaoh had to be put to death. Remember, this is a legal contract. This book and the word covenant is about a legal contract. And so the enemy had a legal contract to us in our life of sin, in our life of religious system. Why do you think? I'm going to go with it. It never dawned on me. Why is it that you're asked to become a member? Sign here on the dotted line. Go through our doctrinal books. Go through our course on our denomination or non-denomination. And then sign on the line that you agree and will uphold and will help in our building projects and everything else. You're going to become a member of our religious system. Maybe, and I know this is a broad brush, seeming judgmental statement, but in most of the cases, that should probably mean come forth, and not the invitation should not be walk down the aisle and become a member of our religious organization. but come down the aisle and sell yourselves into slavery to this religious system. And this is why, in the book of Revelation, prior to chapter 21, which is, I saw a renewed heaven and renewed earth, the old system had passed away. You guys can go back and look at those verses. The chapter prior to that is that death and Sheol, hell, are thrown into the lake of fire. He is not wanting, his desire is not just to deliver us partially, but the very systems and powers and principalities that have kept us into this system of sin and our fallen nature. Prior to him declaring that we are his people and he is our Elohim, the reason he can make the statements in Revelation chapter 21 is because he has put to death the powers, the principalities, the systems, everything. Death itself has been, and the curse that has brought forth death, will be thrown into the lake of fire, totally and completely destroyed. Now, we see in their lives in verse 31 going down here, and I know I'm kind of skipping over some things. That's what it takes in these Torah portions. It says that the people feared Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, and they believed in Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh and in his servant Moshe. Okay, the word fear is reverence and awe. But I'm going to speculate something here in that their fear was more of they became afraid of him. Fear. A fear that is based on the word, and this is where the English language kind of breaks down once again, that there are different types of fear. One fear is that you're afraid of something. The other fear is that you stand in awe of something. You stand on the side of a cliff. We should be afraid of gravity, okay? Because gravity is what will, if you decide to jump off of that cliff, to disregard the sign that says don't get too close to the cliff, to disregard the handrail that is there, is it really the handrail that is keeping you from looking over there too far? Or is it that you are afraid of gravity, the effects of gravity, which is going to be that you will fall and have a sudden stop at the bottom? Well, that same fear that we can have of gravity, we can stand in awe of gravity. For the very fact that I'm sitting here in a chair, the chair is not screwed down to the floor. I don't have to put a seat belt on because the gravitational forces that are around me are of such incredible balance that they keep me seated in the chair, however, they do not crush me. And that should make us stand in awe of the one who brought forth those gravitational forces in such a balance that they do their purposes without destroying us. So you can be afraid of God, but not be in awe of him. Fear, I do not believe, will bring you into a perfect love. But a fear that produces afraid, okay, again, English language, the fear that produces I'm afraid of him cannot produce a path to perfect love. But a fear that is a reverence. A fear that's a reverence can bring me to a place of awe, which can then bring me to a place of love of who He is. Moving on, the next chapter is the Song of Moses. Now we see that this chapter, it says in Revelation chapter 15, that they will sing the song of Moses, the servant of God. There is a day coming, and I challenge you to go into, look at the scriptures in Exodus Shemot chapter 15, and read through those verses. I'm not going to do it here today, but read through these verses, understanding that the writing of these verses is a partial fulfillment of the verses, and they are verses that literally are being walked out on a daily basis upon this earth, but will one day come to the completion, the complete fulfillment, and that will be during the time of the tribulation, that we will see the final exodus, and we will see the final redemption, and we will see the final end to that which produced our bondage in the first place. I do want to go to verse 20. It says, also Miriam, the prophet, sister of Aaron, took a tambourine in her hand, and all the women went out with their tambourines, dancing as Miriam sang to them, sing to Yud-Heh-Vav-Heh, for he has highly exalted the horse, and the rider is thrown into the sea. Now, I know that this makes a great song, but it's more than a song. Miriam going and picking up the tambourine, and her and the other ladies beginning to dance, to praise, to exalt the Almighty. This should have been the attitude of the people throughout the rest of their journey. In fact, I would dare say that if they had continued in this realm, that we would have been reading about a journey that happened over a time of probably 3 weeks, not a journey that happened over a time period of 40 years. We would have the book of Exodus would be shorter. The book of Numbers would be extremely short. And Moses would have never had to give his final address, which is called the book of Deuteronomy. Well, that's the way that it could have been. But because they did not learn the lesson here that Miriam was acting out in their midst, they failed. And that is the next chapter. Well, it's still this chapter, in that they go to the place called Marah. And it is there that they found the bitter waters. What are the bitter waters? The bitter waters are causing them to throw up, okay? It's just a very simple biological thing that they were taken to a place. They're only, 3 days into the desert. The bodily elimination process is moving right along, literally. But they needed a deep cleanse. If you've ever gone through a detox, okay, many people, including myself, we've done detoxes. What is a detox? A detox is something that you take a time and you try to quit putting the bad things in. You take some specific nutrients, some specific herbs that will cause your body to start releasing toxins. So they are taken to the place of Marah, where they're thirsty, So they drink this bitter water, and it causes them all to throw up. They're basically detoxing from Egypt. Well, you know, you can detox physically, but still hold the toxins of spiritual aspects. There are people that I know that have gone through various programs, various teachings. I will hold my opinions of those, other than to say some of them I think are very good, and others, in my opinion, are somewhere around the hooey state. But it's just my opinion, okay? But there is a place in our lives that we need to detox spiritually. How do you detox spiritually? They needed to put Egypt behind them. They needed to put the anger behind them. They needed to forgive. They needed to see that the fingerprint and staff, the authority of the king and his breath and authority, was there in Egypt leading them back to the Father's house. Ah, Bashilak. The word that we started this thing out with. So when you see all that, then you can release that which is in your past. At Marah, what are they doing? They are releasing, it is bitter waters, but in the midst of it, Moshe is told to take a piece of wood and to throw it into the water, and the water became sweet, it tasted good. It had done its purpose. It is there that he gave them, he began to give them laws and rules for life. Well, I see that when we are brought out, what happens? He takes us to the place of the death of Messiah. He takes us to a tree. He takes us to a piece of wood and the bitterness of our life. By placing that piece of wood, not the piece of wood itself, but the bitterness of the death of Messiah placed into our lives, can bring forth sweet. It can bring forth purpose. It can bring forth life into us. And it is there that we begin to see, it is at the death of Messiah that we begin to see the very basics of the rules and the laws that he has given us so that we may have life. But it is the elementary rules and laws. I see it this way, that he began to teach them about how to live. He began to teach them about such elementary principles of forgiveness, of not holding a grudge, of seeing the Father's hand and authority in their lives in Egypt, and how it was all going to be used to bring them into the fullness of the promises, therefore bringing glory and honor to the Almighty. But that doesn't last long, for it's just in the next chapter, chapter 16, that once again, we see this thing of grumbling and complaining, and in verse 3, we wish Adonai had used his own hand to kill us off in Egypt. There we used to sit around the pots with the meat boiling, and we used to have as much food as we wanted, but you have taken us out here in the desert to let this whole assembly starve to death. Whine, whine, whine. Complain, complain, complain. No, I'm not just pointing a finger here, because I've been known to do a little whining myself along the way, a little complaining along the way. Yes, yes, we all have, but understand this. These are prefigurative historical events to teach us. And one of the greatest things that we can learn is how to celebrate that our default mode. What if, when they came to Mara, back a chapter, when they came to Mara, and the first person took a drink of the water and went, yuck, this is bitter, that someone said, Miriam, where's the tambourine? The Father has brought us to a place that is for our own good, and the reason the water is bitter is because there's some things in our life that need to be brought forth out of our life. Everybody, it's not going to be pretty here, but drink up. And Miriam, as we're drinking, get that tambourine going. How would things have been different? Then they get to the place of the Sin Desert. And once again, well, we're hungry. Miriam, where's the tambourine? It's time to celebrate. We're hungry. We need some food. Let's give thanks here. Let's give thanks for the hunger pains that are causing us to remember the days that we sat around the fire in set around the pots with the boiling meat. And we were wiping the blood from each other's backs. We were trying to heal, knowing that those stripes upon our backs were never really going to have time to heal, because tomorrow was going to be another day. Yes, we may have food in our stomachs, but tomorrow night, the stripes upon our backs are going to be more than they are tonight. The slavery is going to be more brutal tomorrow than it was today. Miriam, it's time to get that tambourine, because he's taking us out of Egypt. He's taking us away from the meat pots of slavery, and he's bringing us into a land and making us into a people that he can call his own. Well, again, that's not what happened. Instead, we see the grumbling and complaining. And I want to take you to a verse that I go to quite often in my own life, and a verse that I teach on pretty much every time I get a chance. It is a single verse lifted out, of course, but it's Isaiah chapter 29. I challenge you to write down somewhere the reference to this verse, somewhere where you can find it very readily. I challenge you to underline, highlight, whatever you have to do with this verse, do it. Those whose spirits stray will come to understand, and those who complain will learn their lesson. Ladies and gentlemen, there is something that is, I think, on the Almighty's, the top of his list of things that he does not like, and that is complaining. Grumbling and complaining is a place that destroys our lives. His presence will not remain in that place. Now, he, of course, is going to institute the manna right after this, yes. But in the end, he is going to, it says, I am going to teach those who continually complain. I'm adding that word. Those who they have made a lifestyle out of complaining. I have a person that I know that everything that he does in life, he complains about. He has more money than he could ever imagine. Getting older, so there are some health issues, but overall, I mean, he's had some struggles in life. And I looked at him one day and I said, you know, if somebody gave you a $100 bill, you would complain about the color. And everybody around said, they started laughing. And he kind of laughed too. He said, yeah, I guess I probably would. What are you known for? Are you known as a person that complains? Or are you known as a person who gives thanks? Think back over. If the Father took everything out of your life that you complained about, or that if he took everything out of our lives that we complained about last week, what would we have this week? Well, there would be people that wouldn't have a cup of coffee in the morning, because no matter how you make it, it's never quite right. There would be people this week that cannot get to work because they complained about the price of gas, but yet had the money to put gas in their car. Now, I know, I understand economy. I understand all those things. I understand inflation today as much as anybody does, okay? Well, maybe not quite as, you know, there are people that are destitute. I got that, okay? I'm not making light of this thing. But if eggs are expensive, and they are, but you were able to buy a dozen and they're in your fridge right now, be thankful. Be thankful. Instead of complaining, learning how to be thankful. I want to give you something. Here's a, this is a book that was, I was given many, many years ago. This is 1980s. Before I show you the title, I do want to make a disclaimer that I am not 100% in agreement with some of the theology of this book. There are some issues that I have with some of it. So, you know, if it's, you know, if you're kind of given over to everything is going to offend you, this is probably not the book that you want to get. But if you can read over that, over those things, discerning those things, but yet come to some conclusions regarding it, then I want to suggest this book, which is called Prison to Praise by Merlin Crothers. I read this book many, many years ago, and I have told many people about this book. Again, there are some issues theologically that I do not agree with. With that being said, I want to read you just a short quote, and I won't give you the context of how this is. It's kind of a fun thing how he brings in even the smallest things in life, but I just want to read you a part of it. He says, "Your life is in the palm of my hand, and you can trust me for all things. As you continue to thank me in all circumstances, you will see how perfectly I work out every detail of your life." Are we able to thank him when it doesn't make sense? When things point to I should be grumbling and complaining? I take it very simple. You go to the store today, there's a dozen eggs, they're $8, $9, $10. That's way too much for a dozen eggs. I got it. I remember when a dozen eggs was, you know, I mean, the things that we used to, what we, some people, used to decorate houses with. Isn't it funny? What some people decorated houses with was eggs and toilet paper. And that's, you know, kind of the two things of the last few years. My, how things change. but if you go to the store and That dozen eggs is $10. And you have a $10 bill in your wallet or $10 in your bank account that you can buy that dozen eggs with, would it not please the Father more to thank Him that He has provided for you the price of the eggs than to complain about the eggs? Gallon of gas? Okay, I'll just kind of leave it at that. The next chapter is about the manna. I've told this many times that manna came every day, well, 6 days a week. The seventh day was given to them, a double portion for the seventh day. And in 40 years, no one ever answered the question that was the word manna. For the word manna means, what is it? Well, we read about it in various places. It was coriander and it was angels' food and all these things. But if we really boil it down to it's the Father's daily provision for our lives. And that if we will trust Him in the Shabbat, see, the manna is pointing us to Shabbat. And the manna is pointing us to trust. For if we cannot trust Him for the double portion on Shabbat, then are we really able to trust Him for the daily that He's giving to us? Shabbat is not just about rest. Shabbat is a statement of this very fact. He is with us. Which is chapter 17, verse 7. Of course, once again, the place was named Massa, testing and quarreling, because of the quarreling of the people of Israel, because they tested Adonai by saying, is Adonai with us or not? And the wording there is better translated, is He within our camp or not? Is He? Is He within our camp? Ladies and gentlemen, this is something that must be answered, and it must be answered today. Is He with us in this or not? Brad Scott, a blessed memory, just did a before he passed away, did a message called "Equipping the Image of the Beast." Now I have the MP3 version. I downloaded it from wildbranch.org, and I'm going to give a little plug for Brad. This helps Carol, but if you have never. This was the last series Brad ever did, and it's in Brad Scott style, okay? I mean, there's places that Daniel and I were listening to one of the CDs, one of the MP3s coming back from Mississippi, and it was like when he turned it off, it's like, my brain hurts. I got that. I understand, you know, Brad was Brad, and he's missed terribly today because of his wisdom. But his message, Equipping the Image of the Beast, asks the question in some of the things that he talks about regarding the conspiracies of our day. Is He with us or not? You can go to wildbranch.org, Equipping the Image of the Beast. You can order that on CD. It's a little bit cheaper if you get it on digital download and come straight to your computer. Quality's just as good on that, but I challenge you to get that that series of messages that Brad did, because though it goes into a lot of things of technology, of AI, of genomes, and all those things that I, you know, don't really even understand much of anything about, it goes into some pretty a lot of depth and things. It really, in the end, asks us a question, because he used a verse out of Ephesians that he has given to us, apostles, prophets, evangelists, pastors, and teachers, in the equipping of the saints, the Zadokim, the righteous ones. Are we today, in our lifestyle, are we equipping the image of the Father in His body, or are we equipping the image of the beast? Which basically comes down to this. One is based upon fear, and the other one is based upon faith. If there's anything that Exodus, the book of Exodus, should be giving to us, it is this, that we have faith in a faithful God. Shabbat shalom, Shavua tov, have a blessed, prosperous week. Bezrat Hashem, God willing. See you again next week. Until then, be strong.